Assistant State Public Defender, representing Douglas D. Ms. Hirsch.
Thank you, Your Honor. This is a strange case, not because of its facts, but because of its legal analysis. The historical facts are straightforward and undisputed. 13-year-old Douglas completed a creative writing assignment by writing a violent and gruesome fictional story. His teacher panicked when she read it, and Douglas was sent to the office. He denied any intent to threaten his teacher, and a few days later, he apologized to her and returned to school. One would think, based upon those facts, that the issue in this case is whether Douglas's fictional story can legally and constitutionally be construed as a threat. But it is not, because the first strange turn in this case came up almost 6 weeks later, when Douglas was charged not with threatening his teacher, but with disorderly conduct. The case...
Is there a way that he could have been charged with threatening the teacher? Is there a statute?
I don't want to say that he could have been convicted under this statute, but there is Section 947.013 of the Wisconsin statute.
947.013. Go ahead.
That statute, I think I have it here, makes it a crime to, with intent to harass or intimidate another person, to strike, shove, kick, subject the person to physical contact, or attempt or threaten to do the same.
I guess the analysis, if he had been charged with that, would not have been the applicability of the statute, but whether or not his speech was protected.
I think the first question under that statute would be whether he intended to intimidate his teacher, which I think was really an open question and was the question that was the underpinning of the trial in this case. But there was no fact-finding on that issue. And the second issue would have been then whether that would have been a constitutional violation. And that then brings in the doctrine of true threats from the U.S. Supreme Court doctrine of true threats.
Counsel, I don't want to change the facts, but it's okay. Because of how this happened, this was a creative writing course, and would it have made any difference? And he was put in the hallway because he disrupted, and he sat out there, and so he was completing his, quote, alleged assignment. Would it have made any difference as far as disorderly conduct or threat if he had been in a mathematics class, he was put in the hall, and he prepared the same statement? Would it have made any difference?
Yeah, I believe it would make a difference. I do want to always distinguish, though, today between disorderly conduct and threats. Clearly, if he had come to his teacher in a mathematics class, uninvited, and handed a note saying, if you throw me out in the hallway again, I'm going to cut your head off with a machete, clearly that would be different than this case. It's more likely to be a threat. But I think it's still a threat. I mean, I want to make that distinction in this court. Clearly, the circumstances matter. Clearly, the question is, what did he intend? And was that okay under the threat statute? Was this a serious threat? Was it one that should have been taken seriously? And did he intend to intimidate with his threat? Under the threat statute.
Okay, but we're not under the threat statute. Okay.
My point today is that what the state is asking you to do today is to mix and match these two theories of criminal liability, threats and disorderly conduct, and put them together in a way that allows a conviction that neither statute standing alone would allow.
And that's the reason for my question, because of the context of how this came about, how it developed and what... this was a creative writing course, and there was this alleged discipline that occurred.
That's correct. And it was a class where they were asked not to write an essay or some non-fictional thing. It was clearly a fictional story that he was being asked to write.
But so what's the problem with mixing and matching threats and disorderly conduct? Are you headed in the direction of asserting that this type of conduct cannot be prosecuted under a disorderly conduct, this disorderly conduct statute?
I am asserting that the disorderly conduct statute cannot be applied to this fact situation. that there's a possible argument that the threat statute could have been applied to this fact situation, but to apply the disorderly conduct statute to this fact situation requires two things, both of which were done by the trial court. One, a misconstruction of, this, of the disorderly conduct statute. And secondly, a construction of the disorderly conduct statute that is so broad that it does violate the First Amendment.
Let's just go to the disorderly conduct. Whoever in public or private place, that doesn't seem to be an issue here,
No. Okay,
engages in, and then it says, violent, abusive, indecent, profane, boisterous, unreasonably loud conduct.
Okay. The charge in this case was abusive language, which was part of abusive conduct.
So the charge is abusive, but I didn't read two words in that. No, that's all right. Profane, boisterous, unreasonably loud, or otherwise disorderly conduct. Now, this case is brought under abusive language.
Yes.
And then the argument is that abusive language here is disorderly conduct.
Correct.
Under circumstances in which the conduct tends to cause or provoke a disturbance. Right?
That's correct.
Okay. So I want to get an analytical framework just to see, so I can sort of keep this straight. But the one I give you may not be yours, so you should correct me. So we have an issue of whether this is a under the statute, just falls under the statute. That is, language falls under the statute, the language here, right?
That's correct.
Okay. We also have a First Amendment issue, right?
That's correct.
That is free speech. Now, free speech is protected speech ordinarily, but there are some exceptions to speaking freely. And as I understand it, one exception is a true threat that is not protected under free speech, right?
Can I just talk about that a minute without interrupting your analysis?
Well, that's the end of my analysis.
Okay.
I want to know how the disorderly conduct statute fits with First Amendment and true threat.
There's a second part of the disorderly conduct statute you haven't gotten to yet, which is crucial to our argument, which is that it tends to provoke or cause a disturbance. And our argument on that is related to the First Amendment issue, which is clearly the disturbance that is intended is a disturbance of the public order. The trial court in this case found and construed the statute to apply to a personal disturbance. He specifically said Mrs. Kailwitz was upset, and that's the disturbance. And so part of our argument is that on that second element, the court misconstrued the statute, and that the statute, in order to be constitutional, has to be a disturbance of the public disorder, that every single case about the constitutionality of public of disorderly conduct statutes relates to the public disorder. But going back to abusive language and the threats exception, the basic argument is this, that what's called true threats is a legal term of art. It is not the same thing as simply labeling something and saying, that's a threat, and therefore it's accepted from the First Amendment. That a true threat is a legal term of art. And in RAV, which the state cited for saying that threats were an exception to the First Amendment, RAV, the next paragraph of RAV says, when we say that something is an exception to the First Amendment or not protected by the Constitution, that's just legal shorthand. What we mean, the decision says, is that these areas of speech can consistently with the First Amendment be regulated. And the regulation that the true threats doctrine relates to is a regulation of threatening speech. Every single case, and we've cited in our briefs dozens of the cases about true threats, is related to a criminal prosecution for threatening another person. And some of the confusion in our briefs about what is the intent, what is the element of intent for a true threat, et cetera, is because we're treating true threats as if it were a separate theory of criminal liability. It is not. Every case about true threats, The doctrine of true threats is about where a threat statute intersects with the First Amendment. And so, for example, when there's a discussion about what the intent is in a case that we've cited in our briefs, You have to look back to the statute under which the person was charged.
Why is it inappropriate to regulate it under the disorderly conduct statute then? Is it because that's a general intent statute as opposed to a specific intent?
Disorderly conduct is again, this is, goes to the second argument a little bit. Disorderly conduct goes to the public order. And so the exceptions, the constitutional exceptions to the disorderly conduct statute are fighting words and the incitement to riot, the immediate incitement to riot, the Brandenburg exception. Those exceptions have been developed through the Supreme Court of the court's balancing of the public's right to preserve order versus the First Amendment.
So the true threats doctrine cannot be applied to anything other than a statute which regulates threats.
Correct. It's not a freestanding exception that floats around and you can take it somewhere and put it somewhere. And the best example, the easiest way for me to think about this was to think about obscenity. If this had been, for example, a sexually explicit writing that Douglas had done, and he was charged with disorderly conduct, he went to court, and if the judge had said, well, this is obscene, it's an exception to the First Amendment, and so it's not protected and it can be disorderly conduct. Well, we all know from decades of obscenity litigation that obscenity is a very carefully and narrowly defined crime. If you look in the Wisconsin statute, it's 2 pages to define the crime of obscenity. And the First Amendment's what we shorthand as an exception is really how the First Amendment interacts with obscenity legislation. And so these First Amendment, what we call shorthands, are really the court's balancing of First Amendment interests in a particular context, in the context of a crime. For example, if you look at our cases, it was interesting to
me. Ms. Hirsch, let me interrupt you if I might for a minute so that I can understand what you're saying. You seem to be saying that what was wrong here in using 947.01 was that the threat was directed against the teacher, Mrs. Calwards, or Ms. Calwards. What if the threat had been much broader? What if the threat had been, I'm going to bomb the school, or I'm going to kill everybody in my class? Does disorderly conduct apply then?
Depending on the context, but I think that's a much closer analogy. If Douglas had stood up in front of his classroom and said, there's a bomb going off in 2 minutes, that creates public disorder. That's what the statute is about, and that would be, I think, actionable conduct under the public disorder statute.
Well, suppose I just whispered that to Justice Wilcox. Suppose what happened here is, in effect, a whisper to the teacher. I mean, it was in writing.
If you whispered to...
And it provoked a disturbance in her.
Well, that's...
No one else was disturbed because no one else heard it. Is that good enough under the statute?
Under the disorderly conduct, if she was upset by it. Now, if you whispered that to Justice Wilcox, I think that might fit under the Brandenburg exception to the disorderly conduct, where it's going to cause a riot because he's probably going to stand up and say, you know, everybody run out of here if you say there's a bomb about to go off.
Oh, no.
No,
okay.
He won't.
No,
I'm sorry.
He's the strong, silent type. All distress.
I'm going to leave myself.
Quietly. Quietly, right.
I think that probably raises the question of whether it's likely to provoke a public disorder. I mean, that becomes the analytical question,
okay.
and I don't know exactly what the answer to that would be.
Well, in your case, does it tend to provoke a disturbance?
Well, first of all, I want to point out that the trial court found specifically that it tended to provoke a personal disturbance. So regardless of whether there's a decision as to whether this provokes public disturbance or not, there has never been a fact-finding decision on that. This case cannot, I don't think the verdict can stand in this case because the instruction the trial court gave to itself as fact finder was that a personal disturbance is enough. In this case, I would say that a fictional story written, handed to a teacher, cannot be the kind of writing that would tend to provoke a public disturbance.
And if that's the holding of the court, you never have to get to the First Amendment.
But that's correct.
Okay.
I would say that's correct.
Counsel, a couple questions. First of all, isn't it in a private or a public place? Doesn't the statute deal with that, not just in a public place?
That's correct.
Can't you have in a private place a private disturbance?
Sure, fighting words. Fighting words
well,
fits perfectly,
no,
I think.
Well, no, disorderly conduct that we oftentimes see in domestic abuse cases. In
right.
Someone's living room. Hmm?
There are two. That's correct, and this court has held that that can be disorderly conduct. But for one thing, that's conduct. It's not running as directly into the First Amendment as simple written words are in this case. So when the court construes the disorderly conduct statute, as it has many times, and we cite in our briefs, there's a clear distinction about conduct. And conduct, although it may be expressive, is further away from the core First Amendment protection. So disorderly conduct can apply to a private situation where there's going to be a public disorder. A conduct, a pushing or a shoving, creates
or
a public
violent
disorder.
Or abusive language.
That's correct.
In the context of your living room.
Abusive language that meets the standard of fighting words is likely to provoke a disturbance.
Let me, more fundamentally, though, I have a concern about the argument you've been advancing with regard to true threat. I think I heard you advance the argument that we're not dealing with true threats here because this is not a true threat statute, and where a threat statute intersects with the First Amendment, then we have true threats. I thought I heard you arguing that the reason we don't have true threat analysis here is that this is not a statute that's a specific threat statute to a person. Did I hear you arguing that?
I did.
Yes, that's what I thought. That doesn't seem to be what you are arguing in your brief as I read it, so I need your help on this. I understand your argument in your brief to be, look, you have pure speech. You have speech that's protected under the First Amendment. There are exceptions to that protection. A classification of exception is a true threat. I understood your brief to argue there are a variety of definitions in many jurisdictions of the definition of true threat. The one I'm advancing is the Second Circuit Kelmer decision that defines true threat as unequivocal, unconditional, and specific. So I read your brief to elaborate, to discuss, and to enunciate what you think the test, true threat test should be. However, I hear you arguing that true threat doesn't even apply in this case. Help me out. Seems inconsistent.
It is to some extent. I think that our briefs focus much more on the disorderly conduct analysis, which I still believe is the central issue in front of this court. But the two things happened, and one of which is the beauty of oral argument is that I began to understand my argument better as I prepared for oral argument. The other is the state's argument on the standard of review that it put forward in its brief just got me thinking about this and got me wondering what was going on and trying to understand how all these definitions of threats and all this work came together. The state argues in its brief, and this is what finally dawned on me, the state argues in its brief that the standard of review in this court is the clearly erroneous standard because the trial judge found, as a fact finder, that this was a threat. And I thought to myself, he wasn't charged with a threat. How could the fact finder find that this written story was a threat when the fact finder wasn't given any elements of a crime of threat and wasn't asked to find beyond, that the state approved beyond a reasonable doubt that he had, that the facts met the elements of the crime of threat?
Wasn't he doing that because of the First Amendment issue? Wasn't he finding a direct threat or a true threat because he was concerned about the First Amendment?
I think so, although it's not that clear from the trial record.
Does he give any I don't mean to interrupt, but does he give any analysis in regard to his finding that this was a direct threat? Or does he just say, I find it's a direct threat?
Certainly the First Amendment argument was raised in the court in a different kind of way than it's being raised here. So I think probably it's evolved. He says this is a direct threat, and he talks about why he believes that Mrs. Kailwartz and Mrs. C are one and the same, you know, that kind of thing, the factual argument. And he says, I think his First Amendment finding probably is that there's absolutely no social value achieved by the juvenile's conduct in completing an assignment, allegedly, that makes a direct threat. This is not the type of activity that's allowed under the First Amendment. It's basically the trial judge's finding on that. True threats was never argued in the trial court. The doctrine of true threats was never argued, never discussed in the trial court. Watts was never mentioned, which is, of course, the genesis of true threats. It came up for the first time in the Court of Appeals, and the Court of Appeals said that the trial court's factual finding about direct threat was the same as the legal definition of a true threat. And so that's where this sort of got mushy, I think, in terms of this true threats analysis. And as I finally came to understand this when I looked at the standard of review argument.
Let me just be bold. Pages 1 to 14 in your brief that discuss the analysis isn't what you're going on right now, and I may not be, you know, I suppose one is issues presented. I'm talking about the argument from 5 to probably 14, which lays out that framework that says we should do Kellner, which is true threat, takes Second Circuit, unequivocal. That you're asking us now to put aside.
You're embarrassing me.
I don't mean to embarrass you. That's why I said I mean to be
I think that you're right about that. And so, I mean, I think there's certainly some of the argument in here, for example.
Oh, it's well written and it's great. But you don't want us to really consider it. You want us to say, look.
Yes.
Okay.
Because
this is hard.
Pardon? Well, you know,
finish your question.
Oh, I'm sorry.
You want us to say that this is just not disorderly conduct. Is that what you were saying?
First and most importantly, maybe the argument after page 14 is the argument that as this court has consistently construed disorderly conduct to be a constitutional law, it does not include something that's likely to provoke a private disturbance, not a public disturbance, upsetting somebody's feelings. And it has consistently construed the term abusive language to be within the constitutional definition of abusive language, which is essentially fighting words or words likely to bring on a riot. And the Gooding versus Wilson is the case where the Supreme Court clearly says that if you construe abusive language broadly according to its dictionary definition, then that's an unconstitutional statute. Now, the state comes in and says threats, that this is threats, and it's exempted from the statute. My argument on that is that threats have never been an exception to disorderly conduct, that constitutional doctrine is a limitation on criminal threat statutes. And to the extent that that differs from the first brief, I think there's been an evolution through these briefs. You're correct. This is what I finally came to understand about these threats cases.
Then what is the constitutional impediment? When you attack the statute, you say it can't be prosecuted under this statute. You say because it doesn't fit the words of the statute, you know, it's not, public disturbance, and maybe
right.
It doesn't fit abusive. But also you say that it is violative of the First Amendment. And you do get to a constitutional argument under the statutory.
That's right. Gooding versus Wilson said specifically the words abusive language, unless they are limited to fighting words, are unconstitutionally broad. That's specifically what, and this case was specifically charged as abusive language.
Mm-hmm.
And if that is construed by this court to be broader than fighting words.
Haven't we addressed the overbreadth of this statute, and what was the case? What was that? The 1969 case, the war case. Zwicker.
Zwicker, yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Didn't we say, it's not overbroad, this very statute?
Right.
But now you're arguing overbreadth again.
Well, no, actually, what I'm not arguing that, because I think this court has given the statute the construction necessary under the Constitution. I think that the trial court misconstrued the statute. That if this court affirms the trial court's decision, then it becomes a constitutional question. I think that then the statute, there is a challenge to the statute. But I think that the trial court simply misapplied this statute. And that this court has been very consistent in construing the disorderly conduct statute consistent with the First Amendment's limitations. And so that's why we didn't argue that the statute itself was overbroad. We argued that if it's applied to Douglas, which it erroneously was applied to Douglas in this case, then it would be overbroad.
Let's see if I got the analytical framework, and this probably just repeats what you've just talked with Justice Bradley about. The analytical framework is that the conduct here, which is speech, does not fall within the statutory language of 947.01. That it's said to be abusive, but it's not conduct which tends to cause or provoke a disturbance, because there was no public disturbance here. The only one who was disturbed was one single person to whom the communication was made. That's your statutory argument.
That's the essentially statutory argument.
Your argument on First Amendment is that although language can constitute disorderly conduct, it would violate the First Amendment in this case to hold that the language was disorderly conduct, because it does not fit within two First Amendment exceptions, namely fighting words and incite riot. And that under your present analysis, you don't get into the threat exception because, according to you, it does not fall within the disorderly conduct statute.
That's correct. Can I give you just two minor...
You got...
I have zero time. Oh,
right,
so just,
exactly.
Okay. The argument of the sort of the way that disorderly conduct and the First Amendment argument come together too is also about the definition of abusive language, which I think of as a statutory construction argument, but it also fits into your First Amendment argument, your framework. And the other thing that I want to mention about the tending to provoke a disturbance is that becomes very essential. It's a statutory argument, but it's very closely related to the First Amendment argument, because that is the entire reason that disorderly conduct statutes are allowed to regulate speech.
Because they would be fighting words or incite riot.
That's correct.
Okay,
thank you.
Thank you.
If I may.
Justice Prosser.
If a person in authority received a note today that says, a handwritten note, that said there was a bomb in the Sauk County Courthouse, is it your position that could not be charged under the disorderly conduct statute?
I don't believe so. I mean, first of all, there is a specific statute on bomb threats, but I think the other question becomes contextual. I mean, it's so hard because disorderly conduct requires us to know some circumstances around that handing a bomb. I don't think you can just say there's a threat that says X, there's a piece of paper that says X. There's a lot of questions around it. I think that is much closer. Just the facts you've given me is much closer to disorderly conduct, because it's likely to provoke a public disturbance than our fact situation in this case.
Thank you, Ms. Hirsch. You have several moments for rebuttal. Jeffrey J. Castle, Assistant Attorney General representing the state of Wisconsin. Mr. Castle.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court. I am Assistant Attorney General Jeffrey Castle representing the state of Wisconsin. With me at council table is Assistant Attorney General Mary Burke. This is a case about a threat. Douglas D. made what the trial court found to be a direct threat against his eighth grade teacher, Mrs. Kailwartz, in a story he wrote as a class assignment. When Mrs. Kailwartz read the story, she became extremely upset. In her words, she panicked because she felt her life was threatened. She told the vice principal what had happened, and he too viewed the story as a threat against Mrs. Kailworth. Douglas was charged with being delinquent, with disorderly conduct, and adjudicated delinquent. After the trial court found, in its words, that there was no question that Douglas had made what the trial court called a direct threat against his teacher.
Do you think a direct threat falls under abusive?
Yes, I do.
Okay.
And that is how it was charged in this case. I think one can also, depending on the circumstances, it might fall within the otherwise disorderly conduct, which is
catch-all.
The catch-all, but it's not an unlimited catch-all. It is a catch-all limited to types of conduct that are similar to the enumerated conduct.
The petition here alleged just abusive.
Correct.
Are you, and I read your brief to just be dealing with abusive and not otherwise disorderly conduct.
I believe I referred to both.
Okay.
And I think
so. What are you arguing? The way the petition alleged only abusive, or what are you arguing?
I would argue it's both. And this court, at times as it has analyzed disorderly conduct convictions, has gone through the list and said, well, it's not A, B, C, but it might be D or otherwise disorderly conduct. So I think...
Don't you have to charge? I mean, if you're going to... You might charge everything.
Right.
We won't get into that dispute here. But if you only charge one thing, isn't that what you're stuck with as the state?
Perhaps, yes. But here it was abusive, and I am completely
you're
comfortable.
You're not fighting that.
I'm not fighting that.
You're fighting words about that.
So you're only arguing abusive because that's only what was charged.
Correct.
Am I right?
Yes.
Okay. Real fundamental question for you on this one is, what is the conduct that you are focusing on here?
Communicating a threat.
That's what I thought. Now, see, so your trial court, and that's different than the trial court found, it's different than the Court of Appeals characterized it. The Court of Appeals and the trial court, the Court of Appeals characterizing the trial court, said it was the content of the writing. That's what was the conduct involved.
I think that's a little too narrow.
Well, let's take a look. I am looking at page 3 of the slip opinion, characterizing the circuit court, the very last two sentences.
In the appendix.
Appendix 103.
I got it.
The very last sentence on 103, page 3 of the slip opinion. Finally, it, being the circuit court, determined that the story's content unreasonably offended the sense or sensibilities. It was, let me get to, I think, the very ending, again, where they emphasize it is page 6, appendix 106. He claims his writing was free speech. In looking at page 2, 102, unprotected speech, that is, this court, this is the Court of Appeals now, conclusion, page 2, 102, appendix. This court concludes that the content of Douglas's writing assignment constitutes, it went on with true threat. So it characterizes the trial court, and it concludes content. It's dealing with that conduct, the writing itself.
I don't think we should take that literally, because I don't think the Court of Appeals would have found that had got Douglas written the same essay and then put it in his pocket or thrown it in the trash and perhaps someone a week later found it in the trash, that would have been the sort of...
See, I did take it literally. When I read the trial court's opinion, I said, what is the conduct we're talking about here? What is this disorderly conduct? And the trial court said, it's the writing. And I said, okay, what a Court of Appeals, what are you saying the conduct is that's disorderly? And the Court of Appeals, Number one characterizes the trial courts as saying it's the writing, and number two concludes it's the writing. But in your brief, you advance something, I think, differently. You say it's the student's personal delivery of the writing to the teacher. You say that at the very beginning of your brief, and the second to the last paragraph of your brief, you sum up saying the same thing. Page 25, delivering a threat to a teacher at school is abusive. So my question is, what is the disorderly conduct? Is it the writing where he wrote those, whatever he wrote, is it the writing that's the disorderly conduct, or is it the giving of that writing to the teacher that's the disorderly conduct?
It's the giving. I think writing, if he had done it in his private diary in the home and somebody found it, that would not be disorderly.
Also, so just to put some parameters, if he did the writing, he threw it in the wastebasket, the janitor found it and took it to Ms. C, then in your opinion that would not. But what?
Probably not. I think that would be a stretch. I think one thing that certainly made it disorderly conduct here is he not only wrote what was a threat, but he communicated it to someone.
How did he communicate? What are the facts here?
The facts are that Douglas was...
Did he walk into that classroom and hand it to her?
Yes.
At her insistence or on his own?
Well, he was told to write a story, and as part of the assignment, he was to hand it into her because it was a serial writing assignment. That is, after she looked at it, she would then pass it on to someone else.
I thought the facts were that she came out into the hallway and said, "Give me the story."
Well, did everyone? Did everyone have to hand in the story?
Everyone who was writing the story had to hand it in. I don't think there was any doubt that what he was writing was intended to be handed to his teacher.
And the facts are that the students were instructed to give their beginning story to Mrs. Calwertz when finished, and then Mrs. Calwertz then read the assignment and was going to give it to the other students the next day. Is that what your understanding
is?
Right. And that when, if this isn't your understanding, tell me it isn't. And that when he came back into the room, he sat at his desk and then she collected the assignment. Is that your understanding, or don't you have an
idea? I'm not real clear whether she picked up. I'll have to back out on my statement that he came in and handed it. Whether she walked out into the hall and got it there, whether he came in, I don't know. He completed it before the end of class, and she picked it up with about 5 minutes left. She read it, she panicked, she finished the class, and then reported it to the principal, or the assistant principal.
Is it your view? So your view is it's the communication. So if it was a private, just like if he thought he'd like to use a machete on people, that's not punishable,
that's
right?
That's not punishable.
And so if he writes it in and he doesn't communicate it to anyone, that's not punishable.
That's not punishable.
Go
ahead. No.
No, you please.
When do we end? You can take it the next step. If
he's going to give it to his friends after school, same writing, is that disorderly conduct?
Potentially. I think it would depend whether under the circumstances, objectively, that was seen as a threat or a joke. I think if he sat around with his friends afterwards and they shared a good laugh at how clever he was, that arguably would not be disorderly conduct when it was clear for the context that it was not a threat, it was a joke, that it was...
Not abusive, that's what
it was
mean.
Not abusive.
Was there a testimony presented at trial in regard to any other exchanges between this student and this teacher? In other words, any other incidents involving the two of them?
The testimony was very carefully limited. The questions were focused on what had happened that day. And the teacher when she, in response to the question, you mean that day? Yes, that day. That day, the only incident was he was being disruptive by speaking to the other students. I don't want to read any inference on whether she might have answered yes or no to what had happened. It was the only evidence was what had happened that day.
The note, of course, makes reference to Mrs. C. The note also says that the student, that student was named Dick. Does that mean anything?
Well, that's Mrs. C. Clearly, even though that was a factual issue at the hearing, whether Mrs. C. referred to Mrs. Kelwartz. Mrs. Kelwartz testified, I sign papers in class, I refer to myself in class as Mrs. C. Douglas testified, I didn't mean it to be anyone in particular, just a teacher. Now, the student's name in the story is Dick rather than Douglas. It's not all that different a name. It's
both began with a D.
Both began with a D.
Dismas, Damien, Damascus, Douglas, and Dick.
Yeah. You got it.
Well, should one draw any inference that Dick is in fact Douglas? I mean, why should
I think the finder of fact certainly was free to draw that inference.
Why shouldn't one draw the conclusion that this is true fiction? Because isn't it true that Douglas admitted to a counselor that Mrs. C. was, in fact, his teacher?
There was a dispute about that.
Oh, there was a dispute
about
that.
There was a dispute about
that. There's no testimony, is there, that Dick is Douglas?
No, there is no testimony that Dick is Douglas.
So why isn't that just fiction?
Because the finder of fact can draw the inference based on the parallels, not just the names, Mrs. C. and Mrs. C., Dick and Douglas, but also the parallels in the first part of the story to what had just happened before the writing of the story. In the classroom, the real Mrs. C. kicked Douglas out in the hall for being disruptive. In the story, Mrs. C. sent Douglas out into the hall, and in the story, when Douglas D. spoke again, which is what got him kicked out in the hall in the first place, he whipped out the machete and attacked his teacher. Now, I think that is the kind of is at a possible ambiguity because it's not the exact same name. Yes. But our view is that the resolution of that kind of ambiguity is for the finder of fact. And that's, in fact, what some of the federal cases have held. If there is an ambiguity, if there is a question about whether the statement was a threat or hyperbole, a joke, that is a question for the finder of fact.
That's not a question of constitutional fact? That's subject to a different standard of review?
The federal courts, with the exception of the Second Circuit.
What case is that, Second Circuit case?
The Douglas's brief cites, I believe it's U.S. v. Francis.
I'm sorry for interrupting.
And frankly, as I read the excerpt from U.S. v. Francis, I wasn't quite sure what the standard of review the Second Circuit was using. This is what the Second Circuit says. We routinely use the term true threat in setting forth the second element of the crime. Now, that's dealing with a statute in which threat is an element. While we continue to do so, we note that the question of whether a defendant's communication is a true threat rather than speech protected by the First Amendment is a threshold question of law for the court. And they go on to cite Kellner that and that question is different, they say, from the question of whether a reasonable person would interpret the communication as a true threat, a question for the jury at trial. If my view is if a reasonable person would interpret it as a true threat, as a matter of law, it is a true threat. I want to point out The Second Circuit hasn't been a model of clarity, but the other circuits have been uniform as far as I've been able to tell.
I think the Supreme Court, our Supreme Court's been a model of clarity. And last year, I think, dealing with a, in a different context, but where you have factual questions that then have to be applied to a constitutional definition, we've said that that is, the first is a historical fact, and the second, applying historical facts to the constitutional standard requires a, then a constitutional fact which we review de novo. We did that in the Martwick case last year. We did that the year before in the Phillips case. Justice Steinmetz wrote that case and discussed, if I recall, at length constitutional, how we deal with a constitutional fact versus an historical fact. So we've been going down that trail for a while, not just the Second Circuit.
Yeah, and Marwick, for example, it was the curtilage determination. And the court spent some time talking about whether that is a question of fact or a mixed question of fact and law or constitutional fact.
Counsel, before you continue, I just was looking at statute 947.013, which opposing counsel had mentioned, threat, the harassment, the threat. Opposing counsel seems to feel that under the circumstances here, that this is just a mischarge and you cannot bring this under, you know, 947.01, that disorderly conduct cannot be applied to this particular fact situation. What is your response just to that part of her oral argument?
Two-part response. I think it is possible that this threat, although maybe not some other threats, would fit under this statute, under the harassment statute. It's possible.
You'd have to prove specific intent.
You'd have to prove specific intent.
Right, intent to harass or intimidate.
But the fact that conduct is chargeable under more than one statute doesn't make it impermissible to charge under one rather than the other. That's a matter of prosecutorial discretion. And I want to emphasize, there has never been an argument that somehow the prosecutor misused his or her discretion in selecting which charge to bring. I think that if this court finds that the conduct here meets the elements of disorderly conduct, it doesn't matter whether it might also have been charged under another statute.
Well, let's just check your analytical framework.
Okay.
It's my understanding that the state's position is that disorderly and here in writing, doesn't mean oral or writing, both are okay. That here, a written communication to the person about whom the language is abusive is adequate under the statute, and that that kind of conduct tends to cause a disturbance. And so your position is that if the language disturbs one person, that is adequate under the statute to constitute disorderly conduct.
That is our position. I think under the facts of this case, the disturbance or the potential, the tendency for a disturbance is even broader. But it is certainly the state's position. And so, Justice Geske gave the example of the domestic disorderly conduct, where there are two people locked in the house, and one is making threats of violence to the other. And the recipient of those threats is terrorized. There is no requirement, by the way, that the recipient of the threat be provoked to retaliate. She may be so terrorized.
Is that the case, or was that dicta in that case? I'm sorry, I just can't remember. I read that, but I had a feeling it was an aside.
And I don't remember that either.
Okay, well, maybe we can check it out.
It would certainly...
It may have been good dicta. Is that the state's position?
Certainly, if it's dictum, it's good dictum. And certainly, I think it would come as a surprise to every district attorney and assistant district attorney in the state if that scenario, the domestic dispute, where there are abusive words and one spouse was terrorized by the other's abusive language, that did not constitute disorderly conduct.
Okay, so that is disorderly conduct in your position. Now you've got the issue, it seems to me, if you get past the statute, you've got the problem of the First Amendment, since you're dealing with language, not physical conduct, other than the writing. And on the First Amendment, your position is, I assume, that this language is not covered by the First Amendment because, is it fighting words?
This was not fighting words.
Not fighting words. So it doesn't fall under the fighting words. Is it inciting to riot?
It is not inciting to riot.
Not inciting to riot. So... you agree with the, so far we have total agreement. This is the issue. So we must have a cutting edge, and so the cutting edge has to be here, I would assume, that you think that this falls within the true threat exception to the First Amendment.
Exactly.
Okay. You agree it's a legal term of art?
I do agree.
Okay. Tell us what that legal term of art is. So far we have agreement. Now we, except for the fact
that... Yeah, I think Douglas's brief said, you know, this is really not a well-defined term, but I think it is. I think the lower courts have been fairly consistent. And I'll give you the definition that the state proposes.
That's the one you like.
Yes.
So we have different ones in different cases.
There may be slightly shades of wording, as if you will find courts that slavishly copy definitions without their own little verbiage, I will be surprised. But this one, I think, captures what the Supreme Court was getting at in Watts. A true threat is a serious threat to injure another, as distinguished from political argument, idle or innocuous talk, hyperbole, or jest.
And you accept that.
Just, and I accept
that. Go ahead.
Is that it?
That is the definition of true threat. Now,
give it to me again.
A true threat is a serious threat to injure another, as distinguished from political argument, idle or innocuous talk, hyperbole, or jest.
Mm-hmm. Now, the rest of the story.
Well, the rest of the story has to do with how one evaluates
that.
And the courts have, and I think where there is uniformity, and the courts have agreed that it is an objective test. That is, there are slight variations on how the objective test is framed.
Well, Mr. Castle, let's go through what he wrote.
He said there was an old, ugly woman named Mrs. C. that stood for crab.
That's
now, is there any evidence in the record that anybody ever referred to her as a crab or anything like that?
No, there's not.
Okay, so at least the first sentence, one could say that that's somewhat humorous. Mrs. C. stood for crab. Do you agree?
I'll give him the benefit of the doubt on that one.
Okay, she was a mean old woman that would beat children senseless. Is there any evidence in this record that's anything other than a fictional statement?
No, that one I'll give as hyperbole.
I guess that's why she became a teacher.
Political. or a judge. You know.
One could look at that and say, this kid's got a sense of humor. Couldn't you? She beat kids senseless, well, which of course she didn't, and that's why she became a teacher, because all teachers beat kids senseless.
And you know, maybe part of it was, but I think you have to look at, you can't say, you know, some...
But the whole introductory paragraph, certainly
had he stopped there, there would have been no prosecution. It is not abusive.
Okay, then let's go on to the third paragraph, which is the key here. The next morning, Dick came to class, and in his coat, he concealed a machete. Do you know what a machete is?
I do.
How long is a machete?
I would...
Is it capable of being concealed?
Well, if you wore a long coat.
It's on the coat.
Yes. In today's school environment?
You know, I don't think the question is it literally possible for a person to conceal a machete? It is certainly possible for a student to bring a concealed weapon into school.
Okay, so a concealed weapon, in this case a machete. He whipped it out and cut her head off. And now, that obviously would have had to have occurred in some kind of a remote spot that no one ever saw because he concealed the head for 2 days.
I think you're being too literal about whether this is a threat. The threat is, if you discipline me again, I will harm you. Whether he takes out a hunting knife, whether he takes out a handgun, it is unfortunately the case.
But for purposes of the First Amendment, where we want to encourage expression, and where it is frequently said that the only real answer to bad speech is more speech, what do we have here?
He
concealed a head in a drawer for 2 days and was retrieved only because another student wanted a paper clip.
And that also was not... The concealing the head in the drawer was not the threat either. Let me give you an example. The fact that the threat is embedded in protected speech, whether it's creative writing or political analysis, does not insulate the threat from liability. There was a story on the news this morning about the Federal Reserve Board considering whether to raise interest rates. If I were to write Alan Greenspan a long letter criticizing the Federal Reserve's policies and going into great detail how it's hurting the consumer, how it's doing this, how it's doing that, and I end with, if the Federal Reserve raises its rates again, I will take revenge, I will shoot you.
But if he said, I will take revenge by concealing a machete in my coat and going in and cutting off Alan Greenspan's head, would that be actionable?
Perhaps, yes. It would be up to the trier of fact to determine whether that was a serious threat.
What if the story here was that Dick went home and invented a machine that he could put inside his finger, which was a laser capable of killing somebody, came back to school and pointed his finger at her and started the laser working and it killed Mrs. C?
That would be a closer question for the trier of fact.
Because of the hyperbole involved or the exaggeration?
Because of the exaggeration, it makes it less and less a serious threat. Clearly, you can make the story less and less plausible, therefore less and less...
Do you find this plausible, that he concealed it, that he was intending to conceal a machete in his coat, cut off her head, put it in the drawer, and hope it wasn't discovered?
The question is not whether he was intending to do that. The question is whether an objective person could read this in its whole as
a threat. Objective person.
I try to be.
Do you perceive this as being plausible?
I view it as plausible that he would bring a weapon to school.
Cut off her head.
Well, isn't the point here that what you have is language that expresses great aggression and hostility to the point of wishing someone dead? That's what you got here. And if you were the teacher, you might say, this youngster is very aggressive, very hostile, very angry at me, to the point not of merely kicking or hurting or punching, but a death wish. And if I were that teacher, this youngster is, what, 13 years old?
Yes.
We don't know if he's tall or short, do we?
There's
we don't know if
that.
Mrs. C is tall or short. So, and I'm dealing in a world that periodically I read about some youngster shooting up the place. So I've got a very aggressive youngster. Now, I am very concerned about him. I'm concerned that he has unhealthy thoughts. And I'm even more concerned that the unhealthy thoughts are about me. And that raises lots of problems. And maybe what has to be done is that this has to be handled by the health care providers, the guidance counselors, the principal, the teacher, the family, etc. But that isn't the question here. I think that's the point of Justice Babbage's comments. That's not the issue of whether we have an unhealthy child in an unhealthy society saying unhealthy things, and they're unhealthy about that. The question is whether this is a misdemeanor punishable here through a juvenile delinquency proceeding, right? And making law about free speech. So we got to separate those two things out, it seems to me. And how does the state separate that out? That's really the kicker issue as I see it.
Well,
and I think that's what Justice Babbage is aiming at.
I think to the extent the question is, you know, if I understand the question as, why is this in the courts
right,
rather than in the
why are you bringing under disorderly conduct that deals with disturbance of others when we're talking about really maybe very dangerous language, but is it criminal? What, juvenile delinquency, and do we deal with it in the First Amendment context, or do we deal with it otherwise? That's, I think, the issue.
I think we don't really have a record that explains why this was brought in the context of the juvenile court, because it was never challenged as any kind of abuse of the prosecutorial discretion.
And I'm not challenging it that way.
I can't answer specifically.
I'm not challenging it that way. I'm saying that in the milieu of school violence, and there's a debate here in these amicus briefs whether there really is a great deal of school violence or whether we have exceptional cases, which are very dangerous cases. But in this school violence era, is that why it's brought under a delinquency charge and under this criminal statute? And are we trying to squeeze into this statute conduct that isn't squeezable? I mean, that's the issue. I'm not charging prosecutorial discretion.
I don't think we are squeezing conduct that is not squeezable. I think there certainly will be cases where a prosecutor or, let me back up, because in the juvenile system, we have layers of protection that we don't have in the adult system. We have cases first are reviewed by a juvenile court intake worker who makes then a recommendation on how the case is to be handled. And the intake worker can, for example, enter into a deferred prosecution or recommend that no petition be filed or suggest a petition. Then we have the district attorney making his or her evaluation, and then we have the juvenile court judge who also has the authority to outright dismiss if it's not in the interest of the juvenile and the public.
So I think what the court, at least what I'm struggling with, is, you know, this is kind of a slippery slope. And it's clear to me that if you deliver a note to your teacher and say, I'm going to kill you, that's, but as Justice Bablich and others here have sort of put this in context, the context is that there was some, quote, creative writing here. There was certainly hyperbole. There certainly was some, as Justice Prosser indicated, question, Douglas or Dix, it may not be Douglas, and this is where I'm struggling with this, because I think once we go down this path, it's kind of a, as we say in the court system, kind of a slippery situation to get your arms around and to distinguish this type of case from that where I write to the teacher and I say, if you do this again, I'm going to kill you. And that's clear. But this isn't the situation, and this was done, and as I say, this wasn't done in math class. It was done in a creative writing class, and it sort of arose out of a situation or a context, which I think all of us are kind of, at least I am, concerned about. And that's what we're driving at.
May I respond? My time is up.
Yes, and let's make him brief, because okay. Red light's on a long time now. Thanks, Mr. Castle.
I agree. That is what makes it difficult. That I think if the note had said, if you do this again, I will kill you, I think there would be no argument. I think there might be an argument from Douglas's counsel, but I think there should be no argument that this would constitute disorderly conduct and that it was not protected.
Chief, if I may, one quick one. And that is, if the speech here is protected, does the state think that they could still proceed under the statute of disorderly conduct? The disorderly conduct statute. If it's protected, can you proceed?
No, the court has, in cases like Zwicker said, we construe the statute. It does not apply to constitutionally protected speech.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Castle. Ms. Hirsch?
I just want to quickly address the factual question asked by Justice Bablich. The testimony is that, from Douglas, that when he came back to the room, he believed that he was going to be handing his story to another student to write the next episode, and that student might change it into a dream or something. And then his teacher asked him for the story. He testified, and only when she asked him, he took the story back to his desk, and then she asked him to give it to her. And he actually testified that even when he did that, he wasn't clear that she was going to read it. He thought she just might hand it on to the next student. And so he didn't come into this with an intent that it would go directly to his teacher. It's clearly in the transcript of the hearing.
But the bottom line is that under the disorderly conduct statute, what he intended doesn't really matter, because you apply an objective test to determine whether this was, in fact, abusive language, and then determine whether, objectively speaking, it had the tendency to cause or provoke a disturbance. So what he intended by it isn't really part of the equation, unlike prosecutions
right.
under the threat statute.
That's right.
Or harassment statute.
I agree, and that was why it was interesting to me that the state said that the disorderly act was handing the threat, as they characterized it, to the victim of the threat. Again, it takes it into the threat's context. It's a personal crime. And the state actually, I think, argues in its brief that if you'd given it to other students, maybe it wouldn't have been a crime at all. It seems to me that when you spread something out and broadcast it generally, that's disorderly conduct. That's when you're likely to provoke a public disturbance. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's the confusion between these two crimes that we keep coming back to.
But isn't it possible if this note, if this writing reached other students, another student who was going to complete it, the whole class would know about this.
Exactly. And in that instance, depending on what the context was and what happened, that might have been disorderly conduct. And the question then would become whether under the disorderly conduct statute this was protected speech.
But Douglas intended or expected this to go to a student. Doesn't the statute speak in terms of tends
to cause a disturbance?
Tends to provoke, and it's been construed to mean a public disturbance. Was his conduct of handing this, we argue that it's simply writing the story, and the state admits that writing a story, simply sitting down and writing something, isn't disorderly conduct and isn't actionable. And so the state contends that him handing it to his teacher is the act that's disorderly conduct. And it just doesn't fit in the definition of tending to provoke a public disturbance. As Justice Abramson, I think, said, if she were the teacher, she would be concerned. That's what the teacher was in this case. That was what handing it to the teacher tended to cause, was concern, worry. What does he mean by this? Is he really angry about it? Is, I think, the context of this case. I want to mention one more thing when we're talking about context, which you need to remember, this case was 6 months before the shooting in Columbine. So if the court is concerned about an objective person in these circumstances, the well-publicized Columbine shooting had not taken place yet until after this case was happened and decided. And finally, I guess if we're going to talk about threat statute, I want to come back to this briefly. The state argues that this threats decision is an objective decision, and it cites the Seventh Circuit, actually, for that. It also cites the Seventh Circuit case in Hayward, and interestingly, again, this again makes my point about the threat statute. The Hayward case was a cross-burning case. It's cited by the state for its intent element. The underlying threat statute in Hayward required the state to prove that the person who made the threat willfully intended to threaten and intimidate the people who received the threat. And so I think the court's right. I think that it's possible to say we don't like what he wrote. It makes us very uncomfortable about what he wrote. He shouldn't have done it. It was bad. It was a bad thing for him to do. But we can't throw out legal analysis and say, therefore, he is guilty of a specific crime, the crime of disorderly conduct. We have to look carefully at the elements of disorderly conduct as construed by this statute and determine whether those elements have been met in this case. And I believe that this case neither meets the disorderly conduct definition of abusive language, as that has been narrowly construed by this court, nor the second element of tending to provoke or cause a disturbance. And so Douglas cannot be convicted under the disorderly conduct statute in those two elements of the offense.
Aren't you concerned that if the court would hold that way, that it would be read as a green light for students to write these kinds of threats, whether they're filled with hyperbole or creative writing?
No, for two reasons. One is, first of all, there is school disciplinary action. And actually, I believe the entity that really acted appropriately in this case was the school administration. They investigated the threat. They resolved that. They made him apologize to his teacher. There's certainly school disciplinary action that's available. And as I say, there's a threat statute. There's also a bomb threat statute if students think that they can do those kinds of things. And if they do something that tends to cause a disturbance, and that doesn't fit within fighting words, then I think that they, or is fighting words or incitement, then they certainly can be prosecuted under disorderly conduct. The fact that we don't like something doesn't mean that it fits within whatever crime we want to charge it under. We have to be analytically correct in order to preserve the rule of law.
Thank you, Ms. Hirsch. Thank you, Mr. Castle. The court is in recess a while Assistant District Attorney Kevin Calkins talks with you about the next case we're about to hear.